It's the Brady and the Bunch podcast, presented by 101.3 The Game.
Welcome back. It is the Brady and the Bunch podcast. It is Thursday, May 30th. Hard to believe 27 episodes in, the Vladimir Guerrero episode of our Brady and the Bunch podcast. Last podcast of May. And I told you last week, I'm very excited about expanding the podcast to beyond just our immediate listener base and getting an opportunity to talk with people of prominence in all fields, in all walks of professions that have ties to our local area in Vermont and in northern New York. So it was recently brought to my attention that one of the writers for Beyond the Box Score and Fangraphs.com, two of the most influential baseball sites there are out there, is living in Vermont in our area. So let's go out to the TikTok Jewelers guest line on the Brady and the Bunch podcast. Joining us is Steven Martano, known as Marty in the industry. Marty, how are you?
I'm doing well, Brady. How are you?
Good. I appreciate you joining us. This is awesome. Like I said, I've been looking forward to this now for a week and a half or so since we set it up. How does prominent baseball writer end up living in Vermont? Those two things don't usually go together.
True, and very rural Vermont at that. For my full-time job, I'm able to be based anywhere, provided that I'm near an airport. The baseball piece of it, a hobby that's become really fun for me and a big part of my identity. And, you know, being a baseball writer, or really a writer of any kind, allows you to be based anywhere. I have friends that most of whom I've never met in person, who are really all across North America. And so my family and I decided to hang our hat here in northern Vermont. But it's great because whenever I'm traveling, I do get together with colleagues and friends who I've known for years, and maybe I've met them in person at a conference or maybe I haven't. But it allows and spread out, but it makes a lot of fun as well.
So the baseball piece is not your full-time job. Am I reading that right?
Correct. That's right. Yep.
How much time do you allocate to the baseball stuff? Fangraphs.com, Beyond the Box Score. These are incredibly involved sites, and I read them a lot, and it takes a lot of work to put out that kind of content the way that you guys do. So how much time do you allocate to that side of your, that side of your career?
Yeah, I mean, beyond consuming the games, which I do for pleasure, but there are also times where I want to watch a play because I want to write an article about them. I read an article about them, and I want to critique that article about them. But beyond that, I write twice a week for Beyond the Box Score. I have a Monday column that talks about the weekend review and numbers that you won't necessarily find in other places, that just gives you a sense of what's going on in the league, followed with the really premier pitching matchups or rivalry matchups or something that's of interest that's upcoming, to try to help steer people into some interesting narratives for the upcoming week. Altogether, it's time consuming, but it's also fun. It's the way to make a hobby a part-time job. And so I'm able to balance it. I edit as well at Beyond the Box Score, and I'm a mentor to a number of our younger writers, many of whom have gone and been recruited by teams. And so it's constant. We have a Slack channel where we connect all the time. It's probably an hour a day of work, talking about them with my colleagues and those types of things.
Do you have a favorite team, or does now working in the business, has that sapped you of of fandom and just now caused you to just look at the sport rather than an individual team?
So I do have a favorite team. I am a Red Sox fan. However, when you're getting paid to write about something, you're paid to think objectively about things, the fandom does go away in some respect. I will always for the Red Sox and against the Yankees. It's just the fan that I am. At the same time, I have written many articles, particularly with what Brian Cashman has done with that franchise. And so keeping an objective look, I have friends out there who certainly would say that their fandom has really died. And then there are former Fangraphs writers and former Beyond the Box Score writers who for teams. And so now your employer is the logo on the hat, which makes for an entirely different dynamic.
Now, speaking of the Red Sox, this is coming out on Thursday, but we are taping this on Wednesday, and the Red Sox just yesterday lost this crushing game to the Indians. Everyone's calling it the worst loss for them of the season. They lost 7-5. The bullpen imploded, wasted a great start by David Price. And, it's interesting because the Fangraphs.com people, the sabermetric people say, you do not need to spend big money on a closer. You do not need to have an identified closer every single night. You just need to pitch your best relievers in the highest leverage situations. And the Red Sox have done that, And it hasn't really worked out for them. I think 7 blown saves they have this year. So how does the sabermetric community respond when you see things like what have happened to the Red Sox bullpen?
Well, I think the Red Sox issues really stem back to the problem in April. They got such a slow start out of the gate, and that was primarily driven by 3 times through the rotation that was just horrendous. And so when Chris Sale isn't getting out of the 5th inning and he's laboring and he's giving up 4 or 5 runs, that really puts the team at a disadvantage because he's a stopgap guy to prevent a skid and a long losing streak. From a bullpen perspective, if you were to look at the leaderboard of who's leading in strikeouts per 9 innings, who some of the best relievers are, it's not necessarily consistent. And I think that is the reason that Craig Kimbrel still doesn't have a job, is that teams feel like they can find alternatives at a fraction of the cost and they could put those resources elsewhere. Hopefully they're putting it on the field and hopefully they're putting it into another player, but we know that not all teams do that.
How did you get into writing about baseball sabermetrically?
It's always been an interesting dynamic for me. I have a master's degree in economics and actually wrote my thesis on why pitcher wins really don't tell you much about the pitcher at all. And so that kind of got the gears rolling. Beyond that, I just started connecting with people in the industry who were writing it beyond the box score. I went to Saber Seminar down at Boston College, which is run by Dan Brooks. It's a fantastic conference that raises money for the Sloan Cancer Institute, and they have really the best-in-class people there. Bill James was in the audience. Alex Speer from the Boston Globe was there. And it's such a nice community. It's very welcoming, and provided that you can deliver and you could write, and this is not rocket science, if you could take a narrative and put an interesting spin on it and throw some numbers behind it and some data behind it, you have yourself a good baseball article.
When you hear things in baseball or talks in baseball, hey, we want to limit the shift, we want to get rid of the shift, we want to change the shift, how do you feel about that as someone who is a fan of the game but also sees things from the analytical lens? Like, you know the shift works, so how do you feel about the talk about banning it?
Yeah, I understand the frustration of some fans, because I think that there can be times where there's justification to say sabermetrics is ruining the aesthetics of the game. And there are people out there who will say, there was an NPR segment the other day where they talked just about this on VPR, and one person said, it's not aesthetically pleasing, so therefore it should be eliminated. I don't know that I really agree with that. We can't eliminate things in the game because they don't make us happy from an aesthetic standpoint. I think that over the course of time, the league will adjust and the players will adjust where something's going to give. And it's not easy to throw a bunt down on a 98-mile-an-hour slider. That's a very difficult thing to do. But at some point, if people are getting on base that way on a regular basis, the players aren't just going to opt into outs. It'll be interesting to see how that goes, because it makes the game a little bit less pretty, so to speak. But it does make for a more efficient game and should make for more competitive games.
Marty, I think, you know, because this is not just a question and answer session, it's a podcast, we can have a conversation about it. I'll tell you my view on it. And that, look, I consider myself to be very old school. I'm 29 years old, but I look at the game like, hey, it should be played back the way it was in 1920. It should be played hard. It should be, hey, let's slide in and break up the double play. I want it to look like that. But I've changed my tune on things like the shift. And here's why. Because, as you said, like, the easy answer is, well, just smack the ball the other way. Well, when the pitchers are trained to pitch so that the ball goes into the shift, like, you're not fisting a 98-mile-an-hour Noah Syndergaard pitch into left field. Like, that's not happening. You're going to wrap that ball foul or beat it into the ground to second base. And as much as I was a college pitcher, as much as I like, hey, I want to get out. So whatever the best way to get out that I can get, I'm in favor of. But I look at the NBA. The NBA says you can't play zone defense. What does that do? Well, it opens up the lane, gets you more offense, more scoring, more dunks, more kickouts for threes, more offense. Fans like it. The NHL has changed the way you can play defense. More goals, more offense. They think more fan attention. And the NFL, they're the king. You can't do anything as a defensive back anymore. So all of these sports have made changes to promote offense. I think baseball does need to follow suit. I don't know how to alter the shift. I don't have that answer yet, but I do think there's something that needs to be done. Balls in play need a chance to be hits.
Yeah, so you bring up a couple good points there. As far as promoting offense, there are more runs being scored per game now, and that's been trending up over the last 8 or 9 years. So I think it's more about how that offense is created. I don't know that the root cause of all this is really the defensive positioning. There are some people out there who are advocating for maybe moving the mound back to give the hitters a bit more of an advantage as far as contact, because I think one of the major problems, and you may agree with this, that there's too much three true outcome, meaning strikeout, walk, and home runs, and not enough infield play, and just not enough doubles, not enough grounders, not enough balls that just make it through. And really, you know, if we think about the three true outcomes, you can measure a hitter pretty significantly on what they're doing from a walk, home run, and strikeout perspective. But to go back to the aesthetics of it, is that a game that we really want to be watching? And we know that the pitchers have gotten better over the years, particularly the relief pitchers who are coming in as one inning specialists, and they may or may not blow out their elbow over time, but they're fireballing sliders and cut fastballs and all sorts of things.
You know, you mentioned the home run, and I do, and or the way runs are created. And I want to ask you, I'm sure you have the numbers that can prove this thought. I am a diehard Mariners fan, and they stink, and I knew they were going to stink. I'm surprised that they played so well early, and now they're as bad as they are. Like, I just expected it to be a constant kind of ebb and flow where they win two, lose, or lose two, win one, but it's been like so extreme. But I feel like they do not score unless they homer. Like, they do. There is no such thing for them as single, double, stolen base, single, and there's a four-run inning. It is only scoring by home runs. And I feel like the Red Sox, in some degree, are like that, too. The Yankees have been like that in the past. Do you feel like we are seeing more runs scored just via the home run and nothing else?
Oh, we absolutely are. Yeah, that's basically indisputable, and I think that is cause for a conversation about what can be changed. I know that the Atlantic League has a number of initiatives that they're instituting to see how it changes batted ball profiles and what it does to home run rates versus balls that are in play. The Yankees, I think, are going to set a record for the most home run. I think last year they set the record, beating their previous record from a year ago, the most home runs in a season.
The Twins have 110 homers
it's
already.
Absolutely true.
The Twins are just hitting home runs at a historic rate.
Yeah. The Mariners have nearly 100 home runs already. It's crazy.
And they're already like 10 games under 500. So that goes to show you what good it's done for them. So,
well, I'm just going to mention on the Mariners, you know, from a team batting perspective, they've been better than most teams. Going back to the WRC plus, they've been 10% better than the league average team, but are really struggling on defense. I think their pitching just has not been up to snuff, and we see what happens to King Felix. Throwing him out there every 5 days was not working, and so they're trying to figure it all out from a rotational perspective as well.
You mentioned WRC plus. That is one of the sabermetric stats, and I'll be honest, like, again, I follow it. I could tell you what BABIP means, and I could explain that to somebody with no problem, but there are a lot of stats in sabermetrics that are well beyond my understanding, from defense, like UZR, ultimate zone rating, to offense, WRC plus. What do some of these things mean?
So if you see a plus statistic, this is from a practical standpoint, one of the easiest things to understand once you are educated, and it's very, very simple. So the plus just means that 100 is league average. Anything below 100 is below league average. So somebody who has a WRC plus of 100 is the league average hitter overall. Somebody that has 90 is 10% below the league average, and somebody who is like Mike Trout, who is up in those absolutely ridiculous 350-type numbers, they're just absolutely killing it. Now, that number is derived from a number of different factors, including what ballpark you're playing in, how you're hitting the ball from a consequence perspective. Did you leg a triple from a double? Did you walk more than you struck out? All those types of things. And it's based from runs created, hence the RC. So you're taking a statistic that is runs created, you're comparing that to the rest of the league, and it's a similar and same thing with ERA plus, OPS plus, and anything with a plus at the end. So once you know what it is, you can look at it and you can get a pretty good understanding of how somebody stacks up compared to their peers.
And you're seeing front offices value these qualities, value these stats way more than I would ever have imagined. And I listen to a weekly podcast with the Mariners GM, Jerry Dipoto, and he's constantly talking about their farm system and guys that they're excited about coming up to the big leagues, talking about, hey, he's running a WRC plus of 120 right now in AAA. Like, he's getting close to the majors, and just this language has really taken on a life of its own. You are seeing front offices embrace what you guys do.
Absolutely. Not only are they embracing the ideas that are coming out of sites like ours, but they're also recruiting the people out of these sites. Jeff Sullivan, writing two times a day at Fangraphs, hired by the Rays. there are a number of people on my own staff that I've lost that I think we're in the double digits at this point who are going to be analysts for teams. And they're hiring these people right out of college who have been writing for Beyond the Box Score for 2 or 3 years or Fangraphs for a long time. Even Kylie McDaniel. Kylie McDaniel is the lead prospect analyst for a while. Then he left to go in-house for the Braves. He made some great trades. He actually got them Dansby Swanson in a coup of a trade, and then he ended up wanting to go back into the writing realm, and he's back at Fangraphs. So they're embracing the people and the ideas, and it's really changing the language of the game.
How do you think, and maybe you don't have to deal with it directly, or maybe you do, but some of your colleagues have probably told you, how do players feel about sabermetrics? How do players feel about what you guys do? I'm sure, look, Trevor Bauer is a guy for the Indians who's very, very a huge proponent of sabermetrics. I hear him talking about it all the time. I watch his videos. I listen to his podcast. I hear him talking about it. I got to imagine there's other people that don't understand it and don't want to understand it.
Yeah, there are players out there who want to use these tools and use these metrics to improve and identify their weak spots. But there are a lot of people out there in the majors and even outside of the majors that they've put together a really good career for what's working for them, and they don't want to rock the boat. That's their prerogative to do that. And it can sometimes cause some conflict. Eno Saris, my friend and former colleague over at Fangraphs, there's an article out there about him getting heckled in the Royals. You know, I think that we should all just bear in mind that the way that you consume baseball, there is no right way, and any way that you enjoy the game is great. If the older generation wants to watch Triple Crown stats and watch a home run race and see who's hitting RBIs and that's what they get joy out of, then more power to them. But when we're talking about player evaluation, where it's changed, and some players will be more, quote, old school, and they won't want to know what their BABIP is, and they don't really care that their strikeout rate has gone up 5% compared to last year. But other players, they crave it. And so they'll dive into the numbers. And colleagues of mine who have been in locker rooms and a player has said to them, hey, I saw your article, so I'm trying to address that. I'm trying to address my walk rates down. I think it's the out and in pitch that I'm chasing more. And so that's valuable to the player, that's valuable to the team, and that's valuable to us as fans, because we want players to be the best they can be.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the things that's kind of fascinated me about this is that as teams use sabermetrics more, and I guess I'll look at pitchers specifically here, that scouting reports have come to the point where, hey, we're going to pitch away from a hitter's strength rather than pitch to the pitcher's strength. And I think about it, like, I had a really good changeup, but hey, if my coach knew that guy couldn't hit a curveball, we were going to throw him curveballs even if my curveball sucked. And it felt counterproductive to me to throw a pitch that I didn't have confidence in and I didn't think was very good, rather than throw a pitch that I thought was excellent. And you see that sometimes in Major League scouting reports. Like, I look at these Red Sox relievers that have 98-mile-an-hour fastballs, and I see Matt Barnes leading the league in curveball rate, essentially. Like, some of this stuff is frustrating to me to watch.
Yeah, I think that that's something that the pitching coaches and the pitchers work out themselves. But, I mean, I think we saw this with Sonny Gray, too, right?
Yes.
And sometimes the results just, they don't match the expectations. More locally, Rick Porcello was throwing two-seam fastballs, sinker pitches, all the time, was leading the league in ground ball rate when he was with the Tigers, got to the Red Sox, had that Cy Young year and was great, and then they told him to chuck it for a four-seamer. You know, I don't know what goes behind those decisions. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but they're looking at the numbers that we have available in the public sphere and beyond, because all of these teams have their own proprietary databases, so who knows what's going on in the background.
You know, you mentioned Sonny Gray when he was with the Yankees, and Sonny Gray got a lot of flack from Yankee fans. And he came out in spring training, and it might have been, you know, Saris, who you just mentioned, for The Athletic, who wrote the article, if I'm remembering correctly, and Gray was quoted as saying, like, they wanted me to throw my slider, and my slider stinks, and they wanted me to throw my slider constantly. And it felt like the Yankees kind of ruined Sonny Gray, and that's how I took it.
Yeah, you know, you never know. Ted, from a confidence perspective, you never really know. I mean, maybe the Yankees saw something and identified that a different pitch would be more projectable for injury. Maybe they saw something and said, you know what, to the people who are really best in the league, we think that this is more of a mirage than something that is sustainable. So it would be great to peek behind that curtain, which is why Jeff Sullivan goes and works for the Rays, because he's really curious what's going on from a team perspective.
The
picture, so it's really hard to tell.
What is the sabermetric response to the old school way of thinking, when the old school way of thinking says, Hey, what about veteran leadership? Hey, what about team chemistry? Hey, what about this guy who's playing hurt and he's playing at 70% and that's why some of his numbers are down? What is the sabermetric response to those old school ways of thinking?
I think that there's always an element of the unmeasurable. At the same time, nobody's going to ever say that a team 20 games out of first place has good chemistry. So winning really, really begets some of the narrative behind it. If you look at those, so let's talk all for a minute. Let's look at those Yankees and A's teams of the 1970s. That's true baseball if you're thinking about old school perspective. Many of those players on those teams couldn't stand one another. There was a lot of acrimony in the clubhouse. With the Yankees, Billy Martin being fired over and again, with George Steinbrenner and all the drama. But at the end of the day, it's all about success. So veteran leadership, yeah, I mean, it is good to have a leadership in any organization, whether it's a company, whether it's a team. And that really comes from the top. And right now, they have ownership that's dysfunctional, and that drips all the way through the organization. But at the same time, if you get yourself with a strong roster of players and you get a little luck, those questions go away pretty immediately.
You know, we talk about the game being aesthetically pleasing or not, and I feel like this is my perspective. I want to know if it's yours, that we are extremely protective as fans of the sport that is our favorite. Like, we're in the middle of the Stanley Cup Finals now, and I watch it because I have to watch it. But if it's a Bruins game in November, and you're going to tell me the score is 1-0, I'm not that interested. But a diehard hockey fan, oh, what a great game that was. I look at baseball and say 1-0 is great, but the average fan says it's boring. I don't watch soccer. 1-0 to a soccer fan is great. To me, it's boring. Do you find that baseball fans are more protective of baseball's issues because it's simply their favorite sport?
Yeah, that's part of it. I also think that it's an older sport, and so people have more of a sentimental attachment to it, and many people consume the game the way that the person who taught them to love the game, whether it's their fan or their mother's from Boston is a big Red Sox fan, they're going to consume the game likely in the way that they do. And so it really depends. I mean, people have different perspectives on what that aesthetically for football. There are people who love those 50 to 48 games, and you know, not too many people are really getting excited 6-3 games. But I think that the game is varied enough. This year, one of the is that there have been a lot of blowouts. So there, you see a lot of scores that are like 8-2 and 9-3, and it's more about, it should be more about competitiveness, because a good game is a good game and a blowout is a blowout.
How has sabermetrics impacted the financial side of teams' decision making from your perspective? I mean, I feel like sabermetrics has really given some players that we don't think of as really valuable, has made them valuable, and it's taken players that we thought were pretty good based on the back of their baseball card and devalued them.
The old school slugger Chris Davis style, you know, teams look at that contract as the albatross that it is, and they're a little bit to spend money on the mid to late 30s slugger, knowing that they're really a one career, or at least on the back end of a contract will be a one skill player. And so it really has significantly affected the finance. We saw that this year, players are signing later, players are not getting the deals. At the same time, you know, we have seen players through the minors pretty rapidly. And there are service time manipulation issues that I hope are addressed. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. could have come up in April had he not been hurt, but there was no way he was going to do that because the Jays had no incentive to do that from a financial perspective and a team service time perspective. So there are systemic issues, but sabermetrics and the way we think about the game and the way we use numbers has absolutely impacted and made owners more efficient. Now, we can argue whether that's a good thing. Sometimes that comes at certain players' expense, and sometimes it benefits others.
For the Red Sox, I'll get you out of here on two more baseball questions before I got a couple of just generic Vermont questions for you. But as a fan, as someone who follows sabermetrics, what do you think the Sox should do with Dustin Pedroia? Should they let him? Look, he's got 2.5 years left on his deal. Do they let him just keep trying to come back for all 2.5 years? Should they cut him outright? What should they do with him?
Yeah, it's a tough situation because leadership, and I know Pedroia is well-liked in the clubhouse. Players look up to him and respect him. And you could even see it last night if you watched the game during the rain delay. He's joking with the guys, a good rapport with the guys. At the same time, if he can't perform, then there's no need for him to be on the 40-man roster. It's a balancing act of, okay, we're going to pay you, you can try. But, you know, I think that this is a good situation where you can have a kind of a player-coach combo where he can get his money, which is guaranteed, of course. They can keep him around taking this in a really professional way. And they could really have the best of both worlds while also having Michael Chavis and others playing second base, and that seems to be working out very well for the time being.
How do you feel, because the inkling in baseball is to get younger, get more affordable, get more controllable, get guys under control for 6 years, et cetera. How do you feel about the Red Sox giving a lot of these aging players big money? They gave big money to Sale. They've got big money tied up in Price. They still have big money tied up in Pedroia. They gave big money to Bogaerts, who now I know is only 26, but still big money there. Betts might get big money. Then you're going to have to start talking about just a number of other players that the Red Sox have coming up for contracts soon. How do you feel about them bloating their payroll with some of these older players?
Yeah, ownership knew exactly what they were getting when they hired Dave Dombrowski as baseball operations. It's the same exact game plan that he did with the Marlins to get them their championship. It's the same game plan he did for the Tigers as they were super competitive for that time in the early 2000s. And he's doing the same with the Red Sox. It's just his philosophy. It's a win now. I think Boston ownership saw a window of opportunity. They saw that they had good young players coming up. They could maybe in some cases overspend on veteran players to put together a roster that's the fruit of the labor is 2018 and hoisting the World Championship trophy. What that looks like in 4 or 5 years remains to be seen. It really depends on how they're drafting and who they've held on to and developed over that time. The farm system out in the process of making different trades. And if you look at the Tigers today, I hope that's not where the Red Sox are in another 5 or 6 years, but that comes at the expense of winning.
The draft starts next week. The draft, I believe, is June 3rd, which I believe is Monday. So that's the first day of the draft, at least. How important is the draft to a team like the Red Sox? Because I think it's massive, actually, for all the reasons you just said. Like, they need to replenish the farm system. They're not going to go and trade these high-priced veterans to get prospects, so they got to hit well in the draft.
Yeah, it's important for all teams because regardless of revenue structure or how much they're paying player salaries, this is really a contrived way to keep players in a financial box and get some really great talent. So every team has an opportunity to really make an impact down the line. I think that the MLB draft doesn't get that much attention because these aren't well-known names. There are so many rounds. I don't think it's marketed well, but we're not going to see these players on the big stage until at the earliest, really, probably 2021, 2022. I just did a recap of the 2017 draft, which is on Beyond the Box Score, and the jury's really still out on that draft because it's been a year and a half, and really it's been 2 years, and these players are just, you know, takes time to develop. This isn't football where you can come out of college and be a major impact player.
That's why the rebuilding process in baseball is so painstakingly horrible. Like I feel for Orioles fans that have to deal with the draft and, you know, trying the guys they got back from Manny Machado and other moves they've made. Like, it's going to take you 7 years to get relatively competitive again.
And you have to get lucky. Because the Cubs really hit on their draft picks, as did the Astros. The Cubs with Chris Bryant and the Astros with Correa. These are phenom talent. And yes, they were well scouted, and we knew that they were top of draft. But if you look at the top 10 picks of the last 10 years, there are going to be more unrecognizable names than household names.
Well, look, it's really interesting you say that, because the easy answer when you talk about tanking or talking about trying to rebuild, the easy answer is, well, hey, the Cubs won the World Series, and hey, the Astros won the World Series, and that's true. I've said that as well, but you look at some of these teams like, okay, the Reds, they've been rebuilding for the last 7 years, and they haven't been close to competitive for a while. I mean, you look at what the White Sox have done. Look, they're better. They're watchable at this point, but they're not on the verge of an AL Central crown either.
Yeah, it takes time, and I think that we're seeing more and more that these trades, they include volume. So instead of trading a superstar for a really highly touted prospect and some change, which the other team may not be willing to do in general, but the receiving team on that end, they really want volume because they know that these players, many of them flame out. And so the more options or lottery tickets or potential high upside guys you have, the better chances you have on hitting on one of them. And one player can have a pretty decent impact.
Well, Steven, this has been a lot of fun. Steven Martano, call him Marty in the business. You can follow him on Twitter at SMartano, Rise for Beyond the Box Score, and Fangraphs.com, the Hardball Times, kind of an offshoot of Fangraphs.com. You are living in Vermont, so I got to ask you a couple of Vermont-related questions. I know you're a big skier. Favorite place to ski in Vermont?
So I'm going to do a little plug here because my local mountain is Smuggs, and I'll always have a special place in my heart for Smuggs. But I do a significant amount of work with Vermont Adaptive Sports. So more often than not, if I'm out on the snow, I'm doing lessons for kids with disabilities, whether it's autism or physical disabilities. We get them out there for a half day, full day. They absolutely love it. We have a blast. So we do that out of Bolton, Sugar Bush, and Pico. So that's where I spend most of my time on the snow.
How did you get involved in that work?
You know, my wife doesn't ski, and so I was trying to find a network of skiers that might be a little bit different, a little bit fun, more just something charity related was really speaking to me. And so I have enjoyed very much the work I've been doing with them. We're kicking off our summer season with kayaking and rock climbing and camping. So it's a great program. They're doing great work there. They have a charity bicycle ride coming up in June down in Killington, the biggest fundraiser of the year. And it's been fantastic. It's been a really rewarding experience.
If somebody comes to visit you from out of state, where's the first place that you take them to eat?
Oh, that is a good question. So there is a brewery up in Morrisville called Lost Nation, which many people probably know.
Yeah.
Their food is fantastic. Their kitchen is a box that's about 3 feet by 5 feet, but the food is absolutely wonderful. I don't know how they do it. And then in the summer, they have a great little patio outside and a little beer garden. And so that's where we usually try to take people over there. It's a great little spot.
When you come to Burlington, where's the first place that you go?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a little bit of everything, really. Misery Loves Company is always a favorite. A little bit more higher end, so not an everyday thing, but that's a fun spot over in Winooski.
Well, I was just at our house bistro in Winooski this past weekend having comfort mac and cheese, so that was delicious. So I can definitely support things in that Winooski Circle area, so I'll have to have Misery Loves Company also. Steven, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. It's been a great chance to get to know you. We always love hearing that people in prominent positions in sports and other fields are coming from our area. That's what this podcast attempts to highlight. And, hey, we're going to have you on the huddle again soon, so we'll start that relationship and get it going even further between you and the station.
Terrific. Well, really enjoyed the discussion, enjoyed the conversation, and follow me on Twitter. You can take a look at what we're doing at Beyond the Box Score. We have our draft analysis coming out, a lot of really good stuff. So, happy to be engaged in the community up here and continue doing what you're doing. This is a really fun discussion.
Marty, thank you.
Thanks so much, Brady.